My name's Jen Robinson. I'm a barrister at Doughty Street Chambers, and I've been legal counsel to Julian Assange and WikiLeaks since 2010.
I think for many people, this Assange case has been dragging on and on. Am I right in thinking it really began in Sweden?
Well, in some ways it began in Sweden. I would say actually it began with Collateral Murder and the publication of Cablegate. And of course, Collateral Murder is the video of an American soldiers shooting down civilians and Reuters journalists in Iraq.
They apparently mistook a camera for a gun, I think, and decided to just kill them anyway. And I think the most shocking thing about that is the actual recording of the commentary of these Americans in helicopters, very gung-ho, and the fact that they were killing someone. It was almost as if they were playing a video game, but it wasn't. It was in real life.
That's right. I mean, I encourage listeners to sit down and watch the Collateral Murder video, because it is, in my view, a war crime, in my opinion, a war crime. It was covered up by the American authorities. The head of the Reuters Bureau in Iraq at the time was an Australian journalist called Dean Yates. And he saw answers about what had happened to his colleagues, and they blocked and said, "We've done our investigation, it's all fine. Followed our rules of engagement, it's all fine." Freedom of information requests were rejected over and over and over again. And it was only after the material was released to WikiLeaks, both the rules of engagement and the video itself, and published by WikiLeaks, that the world could understand what actually happened. Now, I think it was at the beginning of 2010 when these publications started that Julian Assange really came on the United States radar. So in my mind, the case really starts with Collateral Murder.
And what was the other one you're saying, Cablegate?
So WikiLeaks has made a number of really important large-scale publications. Early in 2010, WikiLeaks began publishing US diplomatic cables, but it wasn't until later in the year that they published a large tranche of them together with five major media partners. Well, actually, more than 100 media partners around the world, but they started with The Guardian, The New York Times, Der Spiegel, Le Monde, and El Pais. And it was the first time really that we've seen a global collaboration in publication. So it wasn't the first big WikiLeaks publication. In that year, we had Collateral Murder, the Afghan war logs and the Iraq war logs, and then Cablegate later in the year. But it was the publication of the US diplomatic cables, which was probably of the publications the biggest. And Julian really innovated in terms of the way that he distributed material to journalists. So rather than a couple of journalists in global capitals having access to this massive scoop, he made it available to the journalists who could do the material the best justice and to get it out to the most people, to identify the best stories. And so he chose the biggest global newspapers covering the world's major languages, because of colonialism, you know, French, English, German, Spanish, effectively almost covers the world, and released the material in a controlled way, encrypted way, where the journalists could mine the information, identify the stories, and then there was a redaction process by which WikiLeaks, together with the newspapers, figured out how to redact the material so that when the stories went live, WikiLeaks would publish the actual cable. And that's important. We call that scientific journalism. And that allows the public to go and have a look at the document and read the news article, then go and read the article. And you can see for yourself the newspaper's own biases and form your own opinion about the accuracy of the journalism. As a lawyer, I stand up in court, and if I make a proposition, I have to cite a case, and we can all go and read the case and decide whether the proposition as stated was accurate. In journalism, historically, we haven't had that. And WikiLeaks has pioneered this form of journalism that ensures that journalists are held to account.
Now, this is actually a very powerful thing to do, isn't it? Because it involves this whole concept of force multiplication and collaborative working. So the idea is that it's no good having just one journalist or one person looking at this enormous release of cables. Mm-hmm. What you've got is you've got hundreds of some of the best collective journalistic minds in the world working together on the same story.
Exactly. And what was interesting is when we were negotiating Cablegate, I remember Alan Rusbridge saying to me, around the table, "Jen, you'll never see this happen again." Major newspapers working together on a big story and effectively sharing a scoop. But now we see the ICIJ doing mass data journalism projects with journalists all over the world participating. But Julian really pioneered that way of global collaboration, working together. And, you know, he's almost universally loved by journalists in places like Haiti and Mexico and India and Pakistan, countries who recognize that the democratization of information that WikiLeaks has pioneered allowed them access to stories that they would never have otherwise have had access to. And if you speak to journalists in sort of more far-flung, and particularly those journalists who have been affected by US imperialism in their countries, WikiLeaks is really seen in an incredibly positive light, and the way that Julian did that publication was seen in incredibly positive ways.
Okay, so what about the business in Sweden? Because a lot of people I hear saying, well, actually, Julian was a rapist. I mean, he was involved in raping some woman in Sweden, so maybe he deserves what he got.
Look, the Swedish case, I'll say a few things about this. The Swedish case is long past. Julian was never charged in that case. I encourage listeners who are concerned about it to go and read what they can about it online, because it is fundamentally mischaracterized in the press. And what I'll say is that the chief prosecutor in Sweden in late 2010 closed the investigation, saying that the information in the police file did not disclose a crime. And for unknown reasons, the Swedish authorities picked it up and ran with it in ways that were completely unprecedented and reopened the case. I really encourage people to go and look at the facts, because the way it's reported in the media has historically misrepresented what actually happened. And it's very important to note that Julian was never charged. He voluntarily offered to cooperate with the prosecutors. They sought an international arrest warrant for his questioning when we were voluntarily offering his testimony, and the case was dragged out for years on end in circumstances where we were seeking an assurance that he would not be onward sent to the United States to face prosecution, and those assurances did not come. They're very regular in extradition contexts, and they refused to give them. And so in those circumstances, Julian was placed in the position where he was offering to answer the questions about the case, but not at the risk of being taken into custody and sent to the United States. And that case could have been resolved. There are, for reasons I can only speculate about, it was not resolved in ways that hundreds of other cases in Sweden have been resolved before.
It was also interesting that the girls went voluntarily to the police, and then it was actually the police in Sweden themselves that seemed to insist that there could be potentially charges here to turn it into a criminal matter. Is that correct?
There is. I mean, you're casting my mind back to a police file that I haven't looked back on for many years, but there was evidence in the file where that at least one of the women felt that she was railroaded by the police in making her report. Mm. So, you know, it is ancient history in this case in many ways. I do understand that it has made many people uncomfortable about the case, and it's important to always remember that Julian was never charged. Mm. He voluntarily offered to help the authorities with their inquiries, and the way in which the case was pursued by the Swedish authorities was unprecedented.
Now, things have moved on a lot since then. I mean, we're talking about now something like 13 years later, all of which Julian has been either under house arrest on bail or else incarcerated inside the Ecuadorian embassy. Mm-hmm. And there was also, of course, the change of politics in Ecuador that meant that the Ecuadorian government were no longer sympathetic to keeping him there. And then he was arrested. He's now in this high security prison. When did you last see Julian?
I saw him on 2 days ago in prison in Belmarsh. I try to see him as regularly as I can, but it's difficult. When I go to Belmarsh, we only have a 2-hour visitation as a lawyer, and that 2 hours is often eaten into by the security queues and getting in and out of the prison and waiting in the canteen queue to get him an orange and a Kit Kat before I go to see him. So it's a... you know, it's a pretty depressing and grim situation that he's in. But I do think it's important to cover the timeline of events, because people forget what's happened. So in 2010, WikiLeaks published you know, the key publications for which Julian now faces prosecution and 175 years in prison, which are the very same publications for which he's won journalism awards the world over and been nominated for the Nobel Peace Prize each year since. So that's how absolutely absurd and unjust the situation is. But it was 2010 all those publications were made. At the end of 2010, Sweden sought his extradition for questioning in relation to allegations in Sweden that were in the end never pursued. In the following year, Julian pursued his appeals, trying to beat extradition to Sweden, and then ultimately, having sought assurances that he would not be sent to the United States, sought asylum in the Ecuadorian embassy in 2012. He remained inside the embassy for 7.5 years until the time in which he was offered asylum by the Ecuadorian government, was inside the embassy for 7.5 years. And I think it's important for people to understand what his circumstances were like in there. He sought asylum because of the risk of US extradition for his publishing activities, that award-winning publishing activities. He was granted asylum by President Correa, who was president at the time in Ecuador, and his government. He remained in the embassy, which is a ground floor flat in Knightsbridge there in London. He was refused the ability to go outside of the embassy. Now, this was an embassy which, as I said, was a ground floor flat. There was no garden area. There was nowhere for him to go outside. So he was inside a ground floor flat for 7.5 years. He was not even allowed to leave for medical reasons. So it was incredibly difficult. When President Lenin Moreno came to power in Ecuador, there was a change in politics which suddenly made Julian's situation inside the embassy very difficult, even though by then he'd become an Ecuadorian citizen. And ultimately, the Ecuadorian government negotiated with the United States and the United Kingdom to expel Julian from the embassy. He was arrested, taken to Belmarsh. And as we had warned for many years, the moment he was dragged out of the embassy by the police, and he was in a police station, they served him with a US extradition request, which is precisely what he had been trying to protect himself from. He's since been in the embassy for in Belmarsh prison since April 2019 or thereabouts, and we have been fighting his extradition to the United States. The initial extradition request from the United States was for a so-called quote-unquote hacking charge and 5 years in prison, but very quickly was followed by a second superseding indictment where he faces 17 separate charges under the Espionage Act in an unprecedented case in a prosecution that's never taken place against a publisher before using that legislation. And he faces 175 years in prison for receiving possession and publication of journalistic material.
Well, look, this has never happened before, a publisher being prosecuted under the Espionage Act. But if you look at the history of the Espionage Act, it's impossible, it seems, for people not to be convicted under it. So, but what they're doing is they found an act, a little bit maybe an equivalent to the Official Secrets Act here in Britain, which has got a pretty good record of convictions. And yet what they're doing is they're extending it from people who, as part of their job, have access to military secrets of one sort or another, or government secrets, onto the person who's going to publish. Now, this is one thing I cannot understand about why Julian is even in jail, is that he has not taken these secrets himself. No. He was surely handed these secrets by someone from the military.
So the alleged source is Chelsea Manning. Julian has never confirmed that because he would never confirm who the sources are. But Chelsea Manning in the United States, who was a intelligence military officer in Iraq, has since been arrested, prosecuted and convicted and admitted in her criminal trial that she provided the information to WikiLeaks. Now, it's an interesting point and an important point that you raise. Of course, you have people who work within government who have obligations of secrecy to the state, can face prosecution under the Official Secrets Act and or the equivalent statute elsewhere, which in the US is the Espionage Act and associated statutes. But typically we've never prosecuted journalists and publishers. There's never been a prosecution, at least under the modern legislation, under the Official Secrets Act, of a publisher, to my knowledge. There's never been a prosecution of a publisher in the United States under the Espionage Act. And that's because we identify there's an important distinction between someone who has that obligation of secrecy and the importance of journalists being able to report on secret government conduct. So we don't want to criminalise the ability of journalists to speak to people within government and to source information from whistleblowers who might be able to tell us that the government has been acting unlawfully or has stuffed things up or has not been doing their job. That's an incredibly important role in our democracy, that we have whistleblowers inside government who are willing to risk prison and to risk their jobs to show the world what's going wrong. And we must protect the ability of journalists to speak to those sources, access the information from them, receive information from them, and to be able to publish it in the public interest. What this case is trying to do is alleging that Julian conspired with his source by speaking to him, her rather, then him, now her, speaking to her, talk to her about what access to information she has and asking her to provide it. Now, journalists do that in a national security context all day, every day, all over the world. And so by criminalising Julian for having those communications with a source or seeking to, we are putting at risk all national security journalism. It is criminalising the very act of journalism.
Well, that's also a threat to democracy generally, isn't it?
Absolutely. So we need a free and vibrant press for democracy to operate. We need to be able to hold governments to account. We especially need to be able to hold governments to account for actions which take place in secret, which are not subjected to judicial review or democratic accountability. It is very important that we protect whistleblowers and protect the ability of the media to report on it. Otherwise, we lose government accountability. And if we lose government accountability, then we lose our democracy. And WikiLeaks has been an incredibly important tool. Julian set this entire organization up motivated by what he saw happening in a post-9/11 world. Increasing surveillance, lying to the public about going to war, lying to the public about what was happening in the war. That's why the Iraq and Afghanistan publications by WikiLeaks have been deemed to be so important, because they showed us a more accurate picture. We were not being told the truth about what was happening in those conflicts, and the WikiLeaks publication showed us more of the truth.
Well, one of the other things, of course, in all of this is that we seem to be looking at a military and governments around the world where whistleblowers are almost more likely to come forward because of what they're seeing. Some of the evidence, for example, the collateral murder video you're talking about, even people who are actually in the government seem to be more prepared to risk their neck to reach out to journalists with this information in order to correct corruption and, to be frank, evil acts going on within governments and within the military.
Look, I salute them, and I salute each and every one of them for their bravery and their courage and their integrity for blowing the whistle on government wrongdoing, and we should all thank them. We owe them a debt. I believe we need better protections for whistleblowers and a proper public interest defence in our national security legislation to ensure that people who come forward for the right reasons and with information that is in the public interest should not be facing prosecution at all. Of course, then seeking the prosecution of a publisher for publishing that information is pushing the mantle out even further. And I think we need to protect both whistleblowers and journalists who play an absolutely fundamental role in our democracy.
Now, this case with Julian, the extradition, seems to be almost a form of torture. So as it goes on and on, Julian is not really given any resolution. He's incarcerated. And also, of course, psychologically on him, this must be having an awful impact. Are we any nearer any kind of a resolution? Where are we now? And what are the next steps for the extradition hearings and case?
So when Julian went to prison, we've been challenging his extradition in the court. So we have been fighting extradition to the United States using the legal system in this country. And in early 2020, we won the first case. And a judge found that Julian's extradition to the United States should not happen because it would be oppressive. And she found that it would be oppressive because of the severe decline in his mental health and the depressive conditions that he suffers from because of the decade of mistreatment that he has suffered. That he would commit suicide if he was placed under the prison conditions he will face in the United States, which is the deepest dark black hole of the prison system, as it's called, or under special administrative measures, or SAMs, as they're known technically. Now, so the US appealed and they won They shifted the goalposts, offered an assurance saying, oh, well, we won't put him in those prison conditions unless he does something else to upset us. And the courts waved it through, so his extradition was ordered. It's now up to us to challenge that extradition again on the grounds of all of our outstanding appeal points. So we will be challenging the extradition on the grounds of, for example, abuse of process, that this is a political trial, that the US has misrepresented the facts in order to seek his extradition, that this is a flagrant violation of our free speech protections and Julian's free speech protections to seek to put him in prison for the rest of his life. These are just some of the arguments that we'll be raising. It's about to go back before the High Court. We're seeking permission for appeals shortly, and it remains to be seen. It could be going on for the next couple of years, potentially longer. And really, we talk about this as a form of punishment by process, because Julian has been under some form of restriction on his liberty since I walked him into a police station in December 2010. It's almost my entire professional life. It's 12 years of his life. And now he's in a high security prison where he is cut off from his family, from his friends. He's in an incredibly isolated situation on remand in relation to a completely unprecedented and abusive extradition request from the United States government. And I believe this case is political. It always has been political, and it requires a political resolution. We will, of course, continue to utilise whatever appeal mechanisms we have available to us as his legal team to be able to defend him and protect him from US extradition. But ultimately, this comes down, I think, to the politics of the situation. And really, this case should never have been started, and it ought to be for the Biden administration to close the case down for the grave threat that it poses, not just to Julian Assange, but to every single journalist and publisher in the United States.
Well, yeah, and here, and probably in Australia too, anywhere in the free world. Now, you've seen Julian this week. Can you just take us through how he is, and also how you have managed with all the confidential communications as his legal representative you have to have with him?
Julian's situation in prison, he's incredibly isolated. Through COVID, it was unbearable. He couldn't see his family, his children. We couldn't have in-person prison visits with him, so he was very isolated for a very long time. It made our preparations for his extradition case incredibly difficult because we couldn't. It was hard to see him. We had to have video calls. That was the only way we were able to speak to him. We couldn't see him securely in person. These have all been massive impediments to our ability to be able to properly defend this case. But it's also had an incredibly damaging effect on his mental health. Let's not forget, he's already spent 7.5 years inside a room in an embassy, and now he's in a high security prison. And for what? For Nobel Peace Prize nominated publications. It's dragged on so long, and I think people need to resist normalizing this situation and resist continually maintain the sense of outrage at the injustice that it is.
Okay, what about because, I mean, a lot of what Julian has been exposing is about the abuses of the state. Mm. And one of the things I've seen, and has been discussed amongst journalists particularly, is the ubiquitous GCHQ NSA surveillance of almost everything. Now, it's quite key, obviously, to this case that you have a confidential, trusting relationship with Julian, where you know that the other side in your case is not listening to everything you're saying to him and all the communications you're having with him. That confidential client-lawyer relationship is key to getting any kind of proper justice, surely.
Of course it is. And the revelations from Edward Snowden about the nature and extent of surveillance should cause concern not just for journalists, but as I've been saying for many years, for all lawyers, because how can journalists protect the confidentiality of their sources if we're all being spied on all the time? How can we as lawyers protect the legal privilege if we can't necessarily protect against government surveillance? And in fact, I sued the British government and went to the European Court of Human Rights on the grounds that, and the court disagreed with us here in the UK, that it was reasonable to suspect that I was being spied upon, and the UK government agreed that my rights had been violated. This is really concerning, and it interferes with clients' ability to have a right of defence.
There have also been questions raised about the whole judicial procedures with specific judges even having links to the defence establishment in this country.
Yes, there was concern raised with one judge in particular in the earlier stages of the extradition proceedings who an application for recusal was sought because of her connections through her husband to the intelligence establishment here. I mean, that's long, long gone history in this case now, but I do think a lot of people have been affected by the WikiLeaks disclosures. A lot of people in power, a lot of people within the establishment have been affected by them. But I think anyone with integrity and belief in democracy can stand back from it and say that this has the publications have been of immense public interest. They have shown us so much about government abuse, about corruption the world over, about human rights abuse. Just to give you one example, I remember I started working for Julian around the same time they published the WikiLeaks Iraq documents. And at the time, I'll always remember this quote. Julian said, "If lies can start this war, then the truth should be able to stop it." And I remember thinking it was a great line. And in retrospect, though, he was right. He turned out to be right. And the reason I say that is that WikiLeaks published the Iraq war logs, which showed, you know, a far higher civilian death count than had ever previously been reported by the United States government, evidence of torture within US prisons and Iraqi prisons, widespread human rights abuse, and same in the diplomatic cables, evidence of US war crimes in Iraq. As a result of those publications, the Iraqi parliament decided to withdraw the immunity agreement for US troops in Iraq. And so ultimately, those publications did contribute to the ending of the occupation of Iraq. So in the end, Julian, in a way, was right. And I think that's a really good example of showing how if we in a democracy don't know what's happening in the conflicts that we as taxpayers are funding, how can we make informed democratic choices about who we're voting for and why we're voting for them and why we're continuing in a war? And if we don't have access to that information, then how can we possibly make the right democratic choices? And I do think that these publications do have clearly have had a real world impact. One of the things that I found most satisfying of our last extradition hearing was the evidence that we were able to put before the court from a human rights lawyer, Clive Stafford Smith, from Reprieve, a well-known British charity and a non-governmental organisation working on human rights, about the impact that the cables have had, for example, the Guantanamo Bay files, how that material showed, published by WikiLeaks, showed that these people were being held without good reason. Now, we all suspected that, but we didn't know it until we saw it on the page. And that was essential in the campaign in the US to close Guantanamo, which is now Biden's policy. And so it's ironic that the Biden administration is continuing to prosecute the publisher who released that information to allow the campaign to happen. Then if you look at the WikiLeaks disclosures about US drone strikes in Pakistan, the extrajudicial killing of Pakistani civilians, the result of the disclosures meant that there was campaigning in Pakistan and a huge campaign to put an end to those drone strikes. I can give you example after example. The WikiLeaks disclosures, I've used them personally in the Chagos Islands case before the International Court of Justice, where we cited the cables. They were cited in the Supreme Court here, in the case brought by the Chagos Islanders before the British court, but we also cited them in the International Court of Justice in the case that showed that British occupation of the Chagos Islands is unlawful and they should be returned to Mauritius. Now, these are incredibly important documents and revelations that we have been able to put to use in courts around the world to hold governments to account. And people need to remember why this case is so important. I think people forget the importance of the publications, and I really encourage people to go back and look at the stories that have come out as a result of WikiLeaks and that historical archive that continues to sit there and can be mined for so long. I still believe there will be so many more stories in those cables that still haven't been reported, or cables that will come to light as the news cycle unfolds and politics develop in countries around the world, that will shine a new light on what's happening today. And that's an immense resource for the world.
We've also got, we've got a whole wave of strikes. This week we've got the Royal Mail postmen going on strike. We've got a whole series of rail strikes. We've got teachers now balloting over possible strike action because of the what they call the cost of living crisis. Mm-hmm. As the energy prices all go through the roof, seems to me a lot of price fixing going on in the energy market. But that aside, we've also seen barristers this week again taking strike action, largely I think to do with the legal aid, because this is something that under the Cameron government, Kenneth Clark hammered legal aid. And this, of course, means that those with not much money had access to justice. Now they don't. But anyway, why are barristers taking this strike action?
Well, first and foremost, just to express my support for my barrister colleagues who are going on strike this week. So they are striking because of the, I would say, criminal cuts to legal aid budgets in this country, which means that if you are facing criminal prosecution, you are entitled to legal aid and to defence by a publicly funded defence barrister. The problem is that successive governments have massively cut those funds to the point where now my colleagues who are junior barristers at the criminal bar earn £13,000 a year. They earn below minimum wage because, and the hours that you pull as a criminal barrister and the detail of the work that you're doing is really challenging and difficult. But it means that it's difficult to survive as a criminal defence barrister in this country. They can't afford to live. They can't afford to, you know, pay their bills. They can't afford to do the job that they're passionate about. And not in just passionate about, to do the job that is absolutely required by the rule of law and justice in this country. And this means that there are thousands of cases backed up in the criminal justice system because we aren't properly funding the system. It means that thousands of people are in prison unjustly, many of them, because they're waiting for their trial. Our system is absolutely broken. And so if we continue to cut legal aid like this, there will be no barristers left to defend these cases. That is a terrifying prospect for anyone who gets caught on the wrong side of the law, and any of us could be at any time. We know it happens unjustly all the time. People make mistakes, the police make mistakes, people are wrongfully accused, and I certainly would like to know that if I was sent to prison, that there is a skilled and trained barrister who is properly funded to defend me against the state. And at this rate, we do not have that, and that's why they're striking.
Well, the Department for Justice would argue, sorry, we haven't got the money.
We have the money, just where are we putting the money?
Okay, thanks very much for joining us.
You're very welcome.